We're going to start in verse 1 tonight. We're not going to go somewhere else first. So, now that we're getting toward the end of this series, I want you to notice Psalm 49. Just look at the very, very first verse. Hear this, O peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world. Notice it's not the end of the sentence. But when you hear this beginning, what makes this an odd beginning? It's addressed to everybody, right? I mean, typically you don't think of these other nations of wherever they might be in the days of the sons of Korah. Sons of Korah sing these hymns, these songs at the gates of the tabernacle and the temple. And for them to sing this at the gates of the tabernacle or the temple, depending on how many years advanced, to go, hear this, all peoples. And then to say, give ear, all inhabitants of the world. Anyone who comes in here, and were there opportunities where people of the Gentiles could come into the temple? Yes, there were certain restrictions of they couldn't go beyond certain places, but they were there. Now, so this is the beginning of this psalm. It's almost as if you can hear my voice, listen up. Now, I want you to think about Jesus later on in the New Testament. It's specifically there in Mark chapter 11, but we won't necessarily go read it. If you remember when Jesus comes in to cleanse the temple the second time, the same week that he's going to be crucified, he comes in and here they are, money changers are back, those who are selling doves are back, and he makes a statement to all the people that are there, and he began to teach and to say to them, he says, my house should be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a robber's den. What did Jesus know about his father's house? For everyone. He says, this place should be a house of prayer for all the nations. And this is what Jesus is trying to teach them as he cleanses the temple the second time. So, you already know here's with Jesus. He realizes what's going to be offered here is not for just the Jewish people. This is something that spans far beyond that limited horizon. Now, notice verse 2 as this continues on. So, hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. Does it really matter who you are? And you notice the terminology, low or high. He says, whether you're esteemed by people or whether people look down on you. Whether you're low or you're high. Then he says, even whether you are rich or poor, it doesn't matter. He says, and what I'm about to tell you, those things don't really have an effect on whether this message is for you or not. He says, this is for everyone. High, low, rich, poor, everyone together. Verse 3, my mouth will speak wisdom and the meditation of my heart will be understanding. He says, I'm going to speak wisdom. I'm going to give it to you. He says, and I'm going to tell you, he says, and the meditation of my heart will be understanding. And literally, the Hebrew word for meditation means, I talk to myself. Now, I know that may, sometimes people use those kind of phrases and go, well, that sounds like somebody might be just a little half a bubble off. But the idea is, I've really thought about this. And here are the sons of Korah that are writing these psalms by the inspiration of God. And to say, these are things that have truly been thought out. Don't think this is just a song on a whim. So, he says, the meditation of my heart will be understanding. I'm going to give you wisdom and understanding. And then he makes this next statement in verse 4. He says, I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will express my riddle on the harp. So, these sons of Korah, they would play the harp as they would sing there at the gates. And he says, this is what I'm trying to impart to you. Wisdom and understanding. It is for anyone and everyone who can hear their voice. Now, you probably already read on, but I'm going to ask you to not think about that for a second. With all these things together, he says, it's a riddle. usually whenever you think of a riddle, what has to happen next? Someone says, I'm going to give you a riddle. What will you have to do? Solve it? Think about it? There are times even in the book of Judges where Samson tells a riddle. And if they can figure out it, he says, I'll give you all these changes of clothes. But riddle means you've actually got to think about it, and you have to consider what really is the answer here. So he says, I'm going to give you a proverb, and proverb is actually a word that also means riddle, by the way. He says, I'm going to put it in front of you, and you're going to have to decide what you do with it. How frustrating is it when somebody gives you a riddle and you just can't solve it? And sometimes it just sticks with you, and you go, man, I got to figure this out. Surely I'm smarter than this, the way we think sometimes. Now, knowing the introduction in the first four verses, what do you expect this psalm to be about? And don't cheat if you've already read ahead, but just hearing that kind of introduction, what would you assume this psalm would be about? Any guesses? You might think wisdom and instruction. Something good that people should know about. You might think, is he going to talk about the power of God? Is he going to talk about the strength of God? And yet you go through it and think, is this going to be about the glory of God? Everybody should know these things. It's going to be about salvation. What is it? Well, look at verse 5. He says, why should I fear in days of adversity when the iniquity of my foes surrounds me? Now, this is not the whole question, because notice how it goes on into verse 6. He says, even those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches. So what is this really about? What's the real question that gets asked? Why should I fear in times of adversity? Do you understand why they sing this song the way they do? How easy is it to fear in times of adversity? How easy is it to be worried in times of adversity? We start to want to think about all the ways this can go wrong. All the ways is this is not going to turn out well for us. And yet, what they want people to hear, and I think about so many of these psalms that we've been through that are written by the sons of Korah as they sang at these entrances of going, these songs were really tone setters for worshipers as they came into the temple. How many times do we gather together to worship, and what are we thinking about? Something that's really troubling us, some kind of adversity, something that we're going through and wondering, I'm not sure how this is going to turn out. I don't really know. And you go, just as soon as you would walk through the gates to hear this be sung by the sons of Korah. He says, why should I fear in days of adversity? And it's posed in a unique way. He says, when the iniquity of my foes surrounds me, what if I'm outnumbered by a bunch of guilty people? Because that's what iniquity means, right? About people who are guilty for what they've done. And the idea is, I'm surrounded by a bunch of people who don't want to do it right. Now, when you think about this scene, even continuing to verse 6, even those who trust in their wealth. Now, when you think about those who trust in their wealth, there's actually a verse in Luke 16:14. That talks about the Pharisees who were lovers of money. You can kind of see the scene being painted whenever Jesus is being crucified. Here he is in the midst of it all, surrounded by a bunch of people who stand in their guilt to the point where what does Jesus even say? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And yet as Jesus goes through this, do you ever hear any statements that he makes from the cross that are said out of fear? Because he's surrounded by all these people who want him dead. Whenever you think through those seven or so statements that Jesus makes from the cross, isn't it amazing that fear is not what's at the heart of it? What would it have been like for Jesus to enter into the temple and to hear this psalm? Why should I fear in days of adversity? He says, when the iniquity of my foes surrounds me, even those who trust in their will, even the Pharisees who had this plan for me to die, to be destroyed. He says, and boast in the abundance of their riches. Verse 7. No man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him. Now, here's a little bit of a thought here. We know how this is going to go with Jesus. Perhaps the thought is, no mere man can by any means redeem his brother. Now I want you to think about this. How come your life can't pay for mine, and how come my life can't pay for yours? What's the problem? I'm not pure. Sin. Sin's the problem. I've got to pay for my own life. I can't pay for yours. I can't be already indebted and then say, well, I'll pay your debt. So you see what he brings forward here. He says, no man can by any means redeem his brother. How are you going to buy him back? And then the other aspect here, or give to God a ransom for him. And when you think in terms of a ransom, I want you to kind of take the thought, what would you pay God? What do you have of value that could pay for your brother? I mean, your own soul, but who's your soul entrusted to? Think about, while we're in our own sin, can we pay? Do we have anything to pay with? No. I mean, Romans 3:23 talks about, for all men have sinned and fallen short of the grace of God. And you go, what can we offer to God for someone else? Eric. And Noah? Right. I think it's Ezekiel 14, but you'd have to look it up, where it talks about the righteousness of Daniel and Job and says, they can't pay for anybody else. He says, they're not going to stop the destruction that's coming. And really to take time and to consider it even further, do we have anything to offer to God to pay for somebody else? Because whenever you think about it, he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, and that's not a literal 1,000. What's he really saying? Everything is his, so what can I give him? I mean, can I walk into his house and steal something and say, hey, I got you a gift? I mean, you look at this together and really, I want us to spend the time just taking this thought of going, we have nothing to offer God to pay for someone else's soul. And until we come to that realization, you don't see the value of who Jesus is. That there is literally no other way. We have nothing with which to offer to God. We have nothing to pay God on behalf of someone else. Then, verse 8, he says, for the redemption of his soul is costly. Now, not only is there not anything that we could offer, what's the price? It's high. It's expensive. You ever walked into a store, and everybody has to have this experience no matter how much money you have. There's a store out there that sells something you can't afford. And you walk in and you go, I don't have that. I mean, you can probably think of a time in your own life where you didn't have 25 cents and you couldn't even buy anything at the dollar store. And to realize, yet here's the idea, the cost of a soul is so much. He says, you couldn't pay it anyway. You don't have anything of value to offer to God for somebody else's soul. Now, here's the other side of this. I want you to think about how costly it was to God to redeem us. What did it cost Him? His only begotten Son, the only human to ever live a perfect, sinless life. Jesus, when He's born, is not born of wealth and riches. He's not even delivered in a hotel room or an inn. They're vagrants away from home, and the only thing they can find a place to stay is where there are animals. And you think, this is the one that cost God so that we could be redeemed. When you think about what you typically do with something that's perfect, flawless, without blemish, no matter what you're talking about, those kind of terminology leads to a very, very high price. And it doesn't really matter what scheme of thinking you're going off of. When you think of no flaws, perfect, without blemish, unstained, still in pristine condition. And to go, this is what God was willing to sacrifice so that we could have life in Him. I hope you look at that and realize, how in the world are we worthy of that? And to realize that this whole idea is about grace. It's about the grace of God. For you, for me, for all peoples, all nations, anyone who will hear. Then, he says, for the redemption of his soul is costly. Talking about, and this goes back to verse 7, no man can by any means redeem his brother. He says, for the redemption of his soul is costly, and he should cease trying forever. He says, you can't do it. Because before you could ever do it, you have to be perfect. To never sin with your mouth, to never sin in your actions, to never have a wrong motive. And realize, at what age did we miss the boat on those? It didn't take very long, did it? Now you come to Jesus. This is the idea of redeeming a brother. I want you to look over at Luke chapter 3. There's such an interesting way that this genealogy is recorded in Luke chapter 3. Look at the very last verse of the chapter. Luke chapter 3, verse 38. And this is the lineage of Jesus, through Joseph and going on back through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Noah. But look at verse 38. It says, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam. What? The son of God. Adam is considered to be the son of God. So everyone who is of Adam's race would be related to who? And also related to God's other son. Who is that? Jesus. Now, think about that for a moment. So in Psalm 49, it's talking about redeeming a brother. Who is Jesus sent to redeem? He wants all to come to repentance. He wants all to come to salvation. And to go, and this is the price that he's willing to pay so that we could be saved. Those who are of the human race, the line of Adam. Now, come back over to Psalm 49. So when he brings these things up, and he makes these statements, he says, for the redemption of his soul is costly. In other words, his brother's soul is very costly. Jesus pays his life for us. He says, and he should cease trying forever. He says, because you can't do it. You don't have a high enough value in perfection. Only Jesus has that. He says that he should live on eternally. He says that he should not undergo decay. How will you know when someone has paid the cost? What will be the outcome? They won't undergo decay. And how long will they live? Eternally. Now, look over to Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, look down at verse 25. Peter, as well as the other apostles, Pentecost. Sometimes I think of this as opening ceremonies. And yet here in verse 25, the quotation is actually from Psalm 16. But I think you'll see a parallel. For David says of him, talking about Jesus, I saw the Lord always in my presence, for he is at my right hand so that I will not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue exulted. Moreover, my flesh also will live in hope. Verse 27. Because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. How will you know when somebody has paid the price for the sake of all others? They will not undergo decay. Look at how it continues, verse 28. You have made known to me the ways of life. What is Jesus offering? Eternal life. He says, you will make me full of gladness with your presence. Verse 29. Brethren, talking about to the Jews and those who are from every nation under heaven. He says, brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried and his tomb is with us to this day. So was David talking about himself? Nope. Peter's saying, if you think David's alive, just go out to his tomb. His bones are still there. If there's anything left. Verse 30. And so because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants on his throne, David's promise that God had given to him. Verse 31. He looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ. That he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. Way back in Psalm 49, what were the sons of Korah really singing about? About Jesus. Whether they knew it or not, they were even singing about his resurrection. He's not going to undergo decay. Now, he died, and he was buried, but he was raised back up. He didn't undergo decay. Now, if you notice here, verse 32, this Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. And remember that Peter is standing there with 11 other apostles, Matthias included, and going, we are eyewitnesses of the resurrection of Jesus. We can tell you he didn't undergo decay. He says, and we can tell you that he's alive. We can tell you that we watched him ascend to the right hand of God, where he sits in power. Now, come back to Psalm 49. So in verse 9, he says that he should live on eternally. There's Jesus. That he should not undergo decay. There's Jesus. And even if you want another thought, Romans 6:9 specifically talks about Jesus saying, knowing that Christ, having been raised from the dead, is never to die again. Death is no longer master over him. What does that mean if you're never to die again? How long will you live? Eternally. And that's Romans 6:9. So you see these same things being set up in the Old Testament in terms of prophecies, in terms of things that Jesus was going to fulfill in order to pay our price. Back in Psalm 49, verse 10. For he sees that even wise men die, the stupid and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Now, this is just the way it says it. He says, anybody that's looking, what do you notice is the common denominator? Everybody's going to die. Do you ever get enough money where you go, you know what, I'm going to pay enough money and I'm not going to die? Doesn't that sound foolish? If I make enough money, if I could be just the richest person on the earth, maybe I'd be able to purchase life. Doesn't work that way, does it? He says, what about for the stupid? Does it work different for them? No. Here's just an interesting thought for about 10 seconds. What's the difference between stupid and senseless? We don't want to be either one, right? But you notice, he says, it doesn't matter whether you won't listen to anything or whether you're just senseless. He says, the same thing is coming. For all of us, there is a day where we will encounter eternity. And they go, and you can't buy your way out. No matter how much money you have. Then, if you notice it here too, he says, and at the end of verse 10, he says, and leave their wealth to others. He continues on here, verse 11. He says, their inner thought is that their houses are forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own names. Whether you were to build a house today or tomorrow or next year, how long until it needs to be fixed? How long until it needs a remodel? How long before it needs an upgrade? It's perishable, right? I mean, next time you go on a long trip, just start looking for houses and structures that you can tell. They'd probably be better off tearing that down. You'll see them. And yet sometimes we think about those things and we go, oh, you know, that'll be established. Somebody else will live in this house after we're gone. At some point they won't. Because nobody will want to be there. And they go, so what if we're putting everything in wealth? He says, their inner thought is that their houses are forever and their dwelling places to all generations. I'm going to hand this wonderful house down to my great-great-grandchildren. It might not even be standing then. It might not even be worth burning by then. But notice this thought. He says, they have called their lands after their own names. Just real quickly, what country do we live in? America. Who's it named after? Amerigo Vespucci. And who is he? He's an Italian. And he was, of course, a navigator. Touched land in America, at least on two different voyages. And so, isn't it interesting? He was born in 1451 and died in 1512. And you think, over 200 years before the United States of America existed, and yet what do we still call it? And you know, a lot of people don't even know who he is. And they live in this place. Now, you start to notice, people inevitably do this. I mean, how many streets have you lived on that were named after somebody? How many cities have you lived in that are named after somebody? Anybody live in Jefferson City? Ever heard of Thomas Jefferson? Anybody? You start to realize, these things haven't changed. And yet, so many of these people have already passed. And eventually, they'll all pass. Notice here, he says, they have called their lands after their own names, but man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beasts that perish. I mean, the next time you drive by a funeral home, you drive by a cemetery, you notice the gravestones, you notice they're engraved with names and dates. There was one cemetery I was in walking through with actually the one who takes care of everything in that one cemetery. And there's these humongous limestone monuments to people. And I'm like, who are these people? And he gets to name a few of them that he knows a little history about. And I says, well, what about these people? He's like, I don't even know who that is. And he's the one who takes care of the place. And you realize it doesn't take long before the name's all gone. So here's the picture. He says, man in all of his pomp will not endure. He says, you can think you're great. Not going to last long. He says, he's like the beasts that perish. He says, this is it. He says, if you don't have life, then what do you have? Death. Now, notice verse 13. He says, this is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words. You mean there's people who approve of foolish words? You mean there are some wise sage sayings that have been handed down from generation to generation that are really just foolishness? Yeah. And people pass them down as if they are true. Right? Now, he says, this is the way of those who are foolish. He says, they go around with all this pomp and they think they have wealth and they think they have all these great things, and yet the outcome is going to be the same as the stupid and the senseless as well as the rich. Because if you don't have life in Jesus, you don't have anything. No matter how much property tax you pay. Now, he says, and of those after them who approve their words, and then comes our fun little Hebrew word, Selah. Take a moment and think about that again. Now, look at verse 14. As sheep they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. Oh, who's the name of their shepherd? Death. And where does he lead? Sheol. Sheol is a fancy word for the place of the dead or the grave. Now, he says, and just like sheep, and if you've ever talked to anybody who handles sheep, they will openly tell you that sheep are the stupidest of all animals. Now, isn't that a kind way to be talked about? And the reason is because they just follow one after the other. Remember one time hearing a shepherd talk about, you just see the sheep, one would jump out of the fence, and they'd get out, and then people who were with them like, oh no, you're going to have to go get these. He says, it's okay, just wait. And all of a sudden, they all follow that one, and then the sheep jumps over back into the fence, and they all did the same thing. And they go, they're followers. It's like the same words are being handed down generation after generation after generation, and they just keep on doing the same thing. And if it's the shepherd is death, he says, it's just going to go to the grave. Now think about Jesus, John 10. He says, I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. What is he offering? Eternal life. He says, but you're going to have to listen to my voice. Not the voice of death. Not the voice of the masses. Not the voices of the generations past. He says, you're going to have to listen to the voice of Jesus. He says, I'll give you life. And I'll lay down my life, even though it's costly for yours, for your soul, so that you can have life in me. Now, he continues on here in verse 14. He says, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. He says, who's going to rule and reign? He is, the upright. And I don't know whether this is really an allusion to resurrection or not. He says, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Who rules over all the kings and all the lords? Jesus does. And realize, whenever Jesus raises from the dead, when does it happen? happens in the morning when you read through the gospel accounts. He says, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume. And you go, what happens in the grave? What happens to that body? It decays away. It decays away back to just simple dust. And you think in these terms, he says, so that they have no habitation. To think, all that money spent on a casket and a vault and a plot in the graveyard, and what do you really have to show for it? A headstone that you also had to purchase, right? Eric. Yeah. That didn't work either, did it? So, you notice how it continues, verse 15. But God, here's the difference. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Who's going to pay? God. Do you ever consider when Jesus was suspended between heaven and earth being crucified, how hard that was for God the Father? And realize he's willing to endure that so that we can have salvation. How high is the price? I think all of us would say if we had to choose between ourselves or our children to go through pain and difficulty, we would say, choose me. And yet the price is Jesus. Perfection, sinless. It's almost hard to imagine having a conversation with somebody who's sinless. Doesn't it? Now, yet here's the way it's laid out. He says, redeem my soul from the power of Sheol to deliver us from death, because he is the shepherd of life. That's the only place he leads. He won't lead you anywhere else but to eternal life. We listen to his voice, that's where we'll be. He says, for he will receive me. Then you think about the moral of the story. He says, in Proverbs 23:4, David wrote and said, do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. What good is it in the end? It may bring about some relief and comfort now. But really, in the end, what's the benefit? Now, if you think back to verse 12, whenever he talked about man in his pomp will not endure spiritual death and physical death, you look at those and go, it's not going to endure because of pride. And it doesn't matter which side you're talking about. Pride will kill off the spiritual side, and the physical side is going to go too. He says, however, if we'll listen to the voice of the shepherd, he says, you'll find abundant life. Remember Jesus making that statement, you will have life and you will have it abundantly. Isn't that something? Am I alive? I feel like I'm alive. What about abundant life? Do I have abundant life? Then, verse 16, really this section kind of all goes together. Once again, he comes back to the first question. He says, do not be afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased. He says, don't be afraid. He says, why do I fear when I'm surrounded by adversaries and enemies? He says, why do I let that bother me? What can they not take from me? They can't take my soul and they can't take eternal life, no matter what they do. Do you remember the statements? What can man do to me? There's Romans 8. He says, he has no control. Remember what Jesus says? Don't fear the one who destroys the body. He says, you better fear the one who destroys body and soul. And here's God. Now, notice how he continues here. He says, verse 17, and when he dies, he will carry nothing away. Just like in Ecclesiastes, Solomon said, naked from my mother's womb I came, and I'm going to go back the same way. That's a paraphrase. But you get the idea of going, you didn't bring anything with you, and you're not taking anything with you. The only thing you can take with you is, who's your shepherd? And who have you obeyed? Have I followed his voice? Then, notice verse 18. the end of 17. His glory will not descend after him. He says, it doesn't matter what you did in this life. All your trophies, all your awards, how big the banking account is, guess what? It means nothing before God. There's only one thing that carries value before God. And that's the blood of Christ. And that's how we had a response in our lives to him as a shepherd. Then, verse 18, he says, though while he lives, he congratulates himself. Don't break your arm, patting yourself on the back. He says, and though men praise you when you do well for yourself, people will even tell you how great you are. Fools. He says, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They will never see the light. He's going to go down to darkness. Think about how many times Jesus uses the parallel about people because they would not listen, would not go after the things of God. He says, they'll be cast out into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And you go, the pain and weeping because of all the opportunities that we had that we just would not seize. Then he says, he will never see the light. And I wish we had time to go through Mark 9 and look at some things there. But verse 20 says, man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. Should kind of give us an echo back to verse 12. But to realize, here's what's put in front. Can you see why the singers wanted to sing this as people went in through the gates? You need to choose which shepherd you're going to follow. Shepherd who leads you to life or a shepherd who leads you to death. Be careful who you follow. All right. Lord willing, to come back next week, a psalm that's not written by the sons of Korah. All right.